I'm Fred Child. This is Performance Today from APM, American Public Media.
This is listener-supported public radio, KDLL Kenai.
What music is that I hear, Shailen Cochran?
Dave Brubeck for 200.
You are correct.
Yeah, we like that album. The classic Take Five.
It is the music that signals quite often. The Kenai Conversation. Good morning, everybody. It is 10 a.m. Shailen Cochran and Jay Barrett here, along with the ace reporters from the Peninsula Clarion. Introduce yourselves, ladies.
Hello, my name is Kat Sorensen, and I am an ace reporter from the Peninsula Clarion.
Oh. Liz?
My name is Elizabeth Rowell. I'm a secondary ace reporter from the Peninsula Clarion, according to Jay Bear.
I didn't call you secondary.
I did.
Oh, okay, yeah. Do you go by Liz or Elizabeth?
Yeah, it depends. Whichever one is easier for people to remember.
Oh, okay.
I'm a woman of many names.
Ah.
Mystery.
Well, it is a reporters' roundtable here for the Kenai Conversation today, and we have a list of things that we're going to talk about, mostly about news stuff, things that are in the news. But if you out there want to call us and ask us questions about how we do the news, I think we're allowed to. Call us at 3355.
283-3355 is the number to jump in on the conversation.
No, I don't think
that's
what that's plugged into.
That's what it's plugged into. If somebody calls, we'll find out.
It's up to you guys.
Well, it's plugged into 3355, but the little arrow things.
We could do an entire Kenai conversation about the electrical bugs that are going on at the well-lit, if not palatial, KDLL studios.
Yeah.
3355 is the number if you want to get in.
283. Oh my God, we've already got a call. Oh no, look.
Oh no. Oh, that is an entirely different number. 283-8414. The number is 283.
The news never stops.
414.
The news never stops at KDLL.
Thank you, Jennifer.
But we do have, yes, as Jay mentioned, we do have quite a list of stuff to go through because it's, you know, everything's waking up on the Kenai Peninsula. It's breakup. If you haven't been through your own driveway lately, come to mine. It's definitely breakup season, and that means things are warming up, and especially budgets are warming up. The debate over budgets and how best to spend everyone's money and in what areas and to what degree do we want to see those things be spent and all that kind of stuff. So maybe a good place to start off with is sort of at the top a little bit with the borough budget. I know, Liz, we get to share our every other Tuesday evenings together at the assembly chambers. And I've been, I guess, to this point, kind of surprised that, you know, the meetings have been relatively short and we're getting through stuff. But I anticipate that as we get a little bit closer to seeing some hard numbers on Mayor Pierce's budget and see some things come forward, that the meetings are going to get a little bit longer. We're going to see a lot more debate on some of this stuff.
I think we got a little taste of it the other week with the bed tax.
Absolutely.
Reminiscent of our midnight days.
Yes.
We're getting into the season where we start to talk about revenue options and allocation for the school district is going to be the next thing coming up, and that's always a heavy fight because the borough has to decide what its contribution is to the school district before it decides on its own budget, which is always kind of an interesting one because it's about 2/3 of the borough's general fund spending. It incorporates some spending for the college as well as the school district, but an in-kind contribution and maintenance. But primarily the borough mayor, Charlie Pierce, has been talking about it since last year, whenever he started running, that we have a deficit and we need to deal with it. Hasn't really been dealt with yet. There's been some attempts. Right now, the number one thing getting eyed is a proposal from Assemblymember Kelly Cooper from Homer to ask voters whether we can raise the sales tax from 3% to 3.5%. That hasn't been raised in quite a while. Mm-hmm. And it's an attempt to fend off the bed tax, which was really unpopular in Homer and failed last week or last meeting, which March the 6th that was. And that I didn't go over very well because most of the people who testified against it didn't like industry-specific taxes, which makes sense in some ways. And then this sales tax is a broad-based tax, but then there's also been arguments against that already. The revenue estimates are still kind of being worked out, and it's hard to say exactly what that'll shake out as because it depends in part on sales gasoline sales, so gasoline prices and industry activity.
I was surprised as they were debating the bed tax, whether or not to put that on the ballot for the October elections, to see so much support come out for a sales tax increase, because a bed tax is specifically targeted at non-residents. And a sales tax will certainly hit non-residents as well, but would most of the revenue that you get from a sales tax comes from residents. So in essence, they said rather than tax folks who are coming here to visit, we'd rather tax ourselves a bit more, which I found to be a strange development in the ongoing debate about taxation in the Kenai Peninsula borough.
You brought up a really good point that there's been kind of a long shift in philosophy because right now, one of the major concerns that came out of the Navarre administration before he left office was the ongoing shift in the weight of revenue coming from property taxes, which is primarily targeting residents here. Mm-hmm. And because of our senior property tax exemption, primarily targeting younger residents.
Right.
And obviously we have oil and gas tax revenue, but then his administration consciously attempted to shift some of that weight towards sales tax as a broad base, which spreads it out more using the sales tax cap, which was on big purchases, and that, as most of you know, went down very hard mm-hmm. in two elections in a row. And nobody was really in favor of that, and I've talked to a number of voters, but I can't exactly tell you why people voted against that, because the reasons were various. But you're right, that it's kind of interesting to hear that, because traditionally in Alaska, we've been really interested in waxing money out of people who are not from here. And so to tax ourselves is an interesting move.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly one way to help solve that problem. And again, from the Pierce administration, this is what he ran on, was that we don't have necessarily a revenue issue in the borough. We have a spending issue. But he does have an interesting idea to bridge that gap, at least for 1 year. And that's it, looking at the borough's land trust fund, which currently has something in the neighborhood of about $7.5 million in it. And here's another show that we could do just an hour on where that money comes from, what it's earmarked for, and all those sorts of things. But to borrow from that for a year to help pay the debt this 1 year is something that is at least is on the table. But again, it's just a 1 year solution. So, you know, the question has been posed to Mayor Pierce, and this is what he said to me in an interview. And I don't know if his feelings have changed in the last 6 weeks or so. But you know, we're going to do this year, but then we're going to have to look at revenue. So we'll see if that actually holds up. But, you know, the sales tax thing could maybe be palatable for enough folks to get us where we need to be.
You know, I seem to recall that there was talk about a seasonal sales tax, something to go in the summer 5 or 6 months,
yeah,
in the shoulder season, capture more of the visitor revenue.
Something similar to that right now. There's the prepared food tax exemption, which is basically only in effect during the summer months to target visitors who are hitting up Fred Meyer and Safeway and that sort of thing. And then it's relaxed the other 9 months of the year. So it's kind of the flip version of that. I don't know if there's anything else planned in the works to specifically be like a seasonal sales tax on any specific group or anything like that. But that is something that is on the books as a way to, again, target folks who are coming here to leave a few more dollars on their way out of town.
Who else thinks that, Oh, I'm playing pundit right now.
All right.
Yes. I've never played this game. Yeah. Yeah. What do we have? What do we have on the Chiron for our listeners at home?
Yeah.
What breaking news? Yeah. Is happening?
What's the scroll? You know, I think putting questions to voters on a number of things is absolutely the best thing to do. But I also think that voters, in their infinite wisdom, elect people to do things. And sometimes those people abrogate their responsibility by putting things back in front of the voters when they should just be taking care of business.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's revenue.
And that's an argument that you hear a lot about stuff that is slated to go on the ballot. I mean, even when it's at the assembly level, when it's up for introduction, it's easy a lot of times to tell who's decidedly in favor of something because they just want to go ahead and do it anyway, mm-hmm. as opposed to, as you say, in some sense, sort of abdicate that responsibility back to voters to make that decision that they were sort of elected to make in the first place.
It's interesting that you bring that up because I remember there was a commenter at the last borough meeting who basically said, if you guys are going to pass this and send it on to the voters, you need to include a caveat that says, if you don't pass this, we're going to raise the mill rate, which is basically borderline threat, but more like just an acknowledgement of we have to do something. You elected us to balance your budget. You don't want to operate in the same position that the state's been operating in, which this whole time with the borough deficit, I've seen some really strong parallels between decision-making at the state level with our deficit there and then decision-making at the borough level with our deficit here, in part because the numbers are parallel, although we're millions and they're billions. But it's a really interesting point that, like, how much responsibility do we delegate to the voters directly versus representative democracy here where we elect people who make decisions for us.
Well, at least the borough is not considering taking out a $300 billion loan to pay the oil companies off.
Oh, we could spend three more hours talking about the state. Want to talk about the state? We can talk about the state.
But we are... I'm sorry, Jay, you get...
Oh, I was just going to riff on the state.
It's a big platform.
Yeah.
It's a big platform.
You can tap dance on that platform.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say the Speaker of the House and I grew up together.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we were best friends.
Dillingham, small world.
Still got that line of communication open because that could be useful now.
Yeah. I mean, I when he first ran for office, I interviewed him. I was at the Tundra Drums in Bethel.
Oh, wow.
And
cool.
He was coming through. And at the end of the interview, you know, I said, we're off the record now, Bryce. Got to ask you, man. Did I fail you somewhere? Was there something I could have done to have saved you from a lifetime of politics somewhere along the line? Did you not get enough attention as a child?
So. It was all your fault, right? Save that question for later.
I don't think he was breastfed. I don't know.
Well, sticking... This is the Kenai Conversation. It's Reporters Roundtable. We're having a lot of fun this morning. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, share some thoughts with current events around the Central Peninsula, what's doing in your world, give us a call, 283-8414. Again, 283-8414. Love to hear from you this morning. You know, we're talking about the borough budget, but such a huge part of that, of course, is the school district budget. And Kat Sorensen, you spend a lot of time at the Clarion reporting on such matters. And this is something we've talked a little bit about before, and it's interesting to have seen this debate kind of shape up over the last couple of months as budget proposals are going back and forth. And you're hearing a lot from the district administration saying, you know, we've really trimmed up the past few years, and we haven't gotten much in increases and that sort of thing. And there's a lot of worry that more cuts would mean effects in the classroom, which the district to this point has tried really hard to avoid. Is that kind of what you're hearing too?
Yeah, I mean, at the start of this budget cycle, Assistant Superintendent Dave Jones was always very adamant about if there's cuts this year, they're going to be in the classrooms. They've kind of trimmed everywhere that they can trim. I think a major difference between this year and last year that you can see about the kind of dialogue coming out of the district is shifting from a legislature state level to really focusing on the borough. Last year it was call your legislators, make sure they don't cut the funding formula. At the beginning of this budget cycle, the legislatures came in and said, hey, we're not going to cut anything, but you're not going to get any more money. Like, mm-hmm. Don't even bother asking. The dialogue shifted instead to being more, okay, well, let's talk locally. Like, what can we get from the borough? Where can we kind of fill this gap? And the answer is by funding to the cap. I have some beautiful numbers here because on Monday, the school board will be voting on, they just put out the, what's that called?
The agenda.
The Wednesday morning agenda before the Monday meeting. So they'll be putting the budget on, the budget is on the agenda. And they're about 2 million short. They're budgeting, saying that they'll have that 2 million from the borough. So that's funding to the cap. But even with that, they're taking 1.3 million from the fund balance to get a total revenue of 143 million. That's a lot of money.
It is.
That's a lot of money. But if they don't get that funding to the cap, the district is saying they're going to cut, what is it, 11 positions?
Oh. Yeah, and it's interesting because when you hear classroom positions, that doesn't necessarily mean a teaching position. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of support staff in the classrooms, and I know that in covering schools and that kind of thing over the year, I'm sure you've seen this too, those full-time employees who maybe aren't teachers full-time, but who do spend time in the classrooms, they provide a ton of value for those students in those classrooms where consistently we're seeing more students in each classroom and fewer teachers to engage with them on things. And those are the kinds of positions I think that might possibly be up for negotiation, as terrible as that sounds.
Unfortunately. Yeah. And I think as you talk to students across the district, and I've talked to a lot of them, and the overwhelming thing, especially at the high school level, is how much of a difference smaller classroom sizes make. I mean, I remember it from when I was in school and when I was in college, the best classes that I had were the ones where I can actually talk to people.
Right.
You know, it's not a lecture style. So that's definitely the point where it does start affecting the education in the area. But we're broke. you know, I can't listen to Sean Dusick say he can only buy you a black coffee many times. That's his, like, punchline. He's like, come to the coffee conversations with the superintendent, but black coffee only.
Like, yes,
Sean,
it's a trim budget.
I'm not gonna ask you for a latte. I know you can't afford it.
that's interesting. Part of the another part of the debate that's coming out is this idea that we're waiting for the financial situation to get better, and fingers crossed a year or two down the road it will be better. But what you hear more and more is, what about students who are there now? Do they not deserve the same education that students got a few years ago when money was better, and potentially a few years down the road when money will be better again? What about the present? And that's, that's tough.
I think an interesting thing that the district is doing and working closely with the college is focusing on down the line with the gas pipeline and really kind of getting more technical degrees going.
Yeah.
I sat down with Gary Turner and somebody whose name I am not going to remember right now, and talked about the future of the Kenai Peninsula College. And they were saying and really highlighting the fact that now is the time to get into those classes and focus on learning those things, because in 6-7 years, when the gas pipeline is hiring, there's not going to be time.
Not going to be time to go to school and get a degree then.
Exactly. Yeah. There's not going to be that time. There's going to be this lapse. So then people will be brought in from the lower 48, and those opportunities will be missed. And it would be a real shame to have those opportunities missed because of a lack of funding and because of a lack of money and interest. You know, there's a lot of great programs like that. KPC has that huge, amazing building just to teach people how to do that stuff.
Right.
And then even on a different level too, there's the firefighter program out in Nikiski where they're training kids to be firefighters, and all of these different like technical things that I think are a really good thing to focus on now, because I think those are the kind of jobs in this area that should be getting more funding and more attention, but they can't. So it's a give and take.
I saw that same thing at the job and career fair last week.
Mm-hmm.
I talked with the woman from the Carpenters Union and the one from the IBEW, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. They have programs where they will pay you to train you.
Yeah.
You know, the parts of it you have to pay for sometimes, the early parts, classroom, maybe books, but there are scholarships.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's an amazing thing. You go, you can, or, and then there's Seward, Avtech.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Go learn welding and go ahead.
Homer talked about its marine trades group that came into the borough and mentioned that they built a whole wing at Homer High specifically to train kids to work in the Homer marine trades. And that when I was talking to the harbor master and Homer about their derelict vessel problem. He mentioned that it's going to be a windfall for people who had the skills to build boats in about 10 years. We got to fix the derelict vessel problem first with what to do with them, but we got to build more boats. And people are not coming up with those skills, in part because the shift pressure everybody to go to college for a while.
And that's, I think, something that the school district does really well is having those opportunities for children to be more involved in the technical trades, because if you look at it down the line, that's how we're going to get out of this financial pickle. You know, it's not by bringing people in from the lower 48. We need to be able to generate that revenue and give those jobs to the students here.
You don't think that you don't think growth from outside is a realistic thing? I hear, because
I think it's realistic.
Part of what I hear a lot is more people wanting to emphasize tourism and specifically emphasize bringing people in to take advantage of things that we haven't really put a whole lot of effort into.
And that's probably why we're not having a bed tax.
That is part of it as well.
That's kind of a trap, because Alaska has this tendency, or so it seems to me. I'm not 50 years old. The state's only about 50 years old. But the tendency in the state is to, when we have trouble in one industry, put all of our energy into another single industry. In this case, it's tourism. So we're moving off of oil and picking tourism, and there's only so much capacity. I mean, you hear about these Kenai River sport fishing capacity studies, for example, that happened about like 15 years ago. How many more of you want another 300 anglers standing on the bank right below the Kenai River Center? How much more capacity do we need to build out these lodges that are only going to be used for 3 or 4 months? And then we have to keep the infrastructure. We have to make them available. We have to make sure the paving works to get them there. We have to maintain our 911 service to make sure that we can serve 17,000 extra people. And so in some ways, because of the seasonality of Alaska, it makes expanding the tourism industry year-round pretty hard. Then getting on and off the peninsula, as we all know, we don't leave the peninsula that much in the winter. So trying to get tourists here in the winter might be hard.
I went to Anchorage once.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
And that was exciting. It's an adventure, right?
Yeah. I saw Lady Bird. It was really great. I definitely agree with that tourism aspect of it, and I think the tourism industry is great, and I'd love to see it grow and continue and go into a year-round industry, because there are so many amazing things to do here year-round. But I think the big focus has to be, if you're going to a Kenai Central High School graduation or a Sohi graduation or a Kiski graduation, and you go and you ask the students, I would like more of them to say that they're staying around here and going to school here and really looking forward to the next chapter of their life being in this area, instead of saying, oh, I can't wait to get out of here and go to the lower 48 and get a good job and just get out of here. You know, because, they can get out of here for 4 years and then they'll come back and, I don't know, what are you going to do? I want to build the people around here.
And this coming from three people who are from somewhere else?
But
we all
I care.
Did precisely that.
Well, that's the story of Alaska, right? Everyone's from somewhere else.
It reminds me of when I was ripping on Iowa.
Oh,
easy.
After coming back from my trip, and Shaylin, who is from Iowa, said, "Hey, why are you ripping on Iowa? That's nice." I said, "Everyone I know from Iowa has moved to Alaska."
Well, I just realized that I've been saying the word Minneapolis wrong my entire life.
What?
Apparently, it's Minneapolis, not Minneapolis. Oh. I've been just joining together Indianapolis and Minneapolis. See, I can't even
exactly.
Do it.
Yeah.
Right now, where are you from?
New Jersey.
Ah.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
You're from Jersey?
Yeah, Jersey. I eat pork while I listen to Bruce Springsteen on the boardwalk.
Oh, my Lord.
Do you remember Joe Piscopo? I mean, have you seen Joe Piscopo's character?
Yes.
I certainly don't remember it.
I have seen it, and I have lived it.
Well, this is the Kenai Conversation this morning on KDLL Reporters Roundtable. Happy to have Liz Earle and Kat Sorensen in the studio with us. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, chat a little bit about what's going on around the Central Peninsula right now, 283-8414 is the number. Again, 283-8414.
Operators are standing by.
Operators are standing by, ready to take your pledge as well. talking about some of the budget things coming up, I've been paying attention to a few things cycling through the legislature in terms of fishing things. And I know that we've all kind of done our rounds of stories on the commercial outlooks and the sockeye outlooks and those sorts of things. But there's some interesting stuff kind of moving through the legislature that would have, I would assume, some significant effects here on the peninsula. There's a couple things I'm thinking about is Senator Gary Stevens is working on a bill to sort of address the issue of the graying of the commercial fleet and figure out some ways to sort of incentivize getting younger folks into that industry. And then there's also some degree to the same idea of how to see that industry move forward into the future and remain healthy. Senator Michiki also has a bill working on commercial permit buybacks, and that's something, Liz, I know that you're paying a lot of attention to, and it's interesting to see some of these efforts go toward, all right, we're talking a lot about what's the next step, how do we get from where we are now to, you know, a sustainable future, and that's happening in the fishing industry as well.
And the curious thing about all of those bills is that they're all circulating around the same idea, which is how do we use the resources we have sustainably and yet make this industry profitable for the individual members? Because right now, for a lot of them, it's not, at least especially not on the small boat fleet. When you're talking about like the small guys who longline for halibut out of Kodiak or who go fishing with their one set of nets, drift netting and Cook Inlet for 6 weeks at a time, that sort of thing. Because when you talk to these fishermen, maybe the historical story is that they make their killing in 6 weeks in the summer and then just get to kick back all fall. But that's not the way it works anymore. And so when you brought up the set net ban, set net buyback, mm-hmm. Having memory flashbacks here to other legislative activity. The principle behind it is in part to help alleviate some of the stress of the fishing wars between the sport fishing industry and the commercial fishing industry in Cook Inlet, because one of the arguments that's long been standing is that we have too many permits in Cook Inlet. And depending on which side of the argument you stand on, you can say that's true or not true. But what I've heard from both proponents and from opponents is that the one thing it would do is it would leave more in terms of profit for those that are left. And so the ones who would, I can't remember the precise number right now for the amount that they would be able to have their permits purchased for. And the debate is still out there as to how we would fund this, because the legislature is certainly not going to pay for it.
Right.
We have way too many other things to pay for. But it would basically take out those guys, give them a chance to sell back their permits if they wanted to get out of the fishery anyway, close out those permits permanently, and then leave the ones who are left behind to have more fish to harvest, make them a more profitable, long-lasting fishery. And then in combination with, like you said, the graying of the fleet problem, you don't meet many fishermen, especially shore-based ones, who are younger, who are getting into this in their 20s or their 30s, in part because of the cost of permits, cost of gear, and the incredible fluctuation of the fishery. We've seen the 2016 disasters in the pink salmon fishery all over the Gulf of Alaska, and then the appropriation of disaster monies for that. The fishery is just a really unpredictable one in salmon, and so it's hard to incentivize younger people to say, yeah, I'm going to go be a commercial fisherman all my life. And so in some ways, it's an attempt to stabilize that market. So one of the things I've heard talked about is allowing people to go in together on a CFEC permit and have a community commercial fishing permit. And that would allow people to sort of, share it, mm-hmm. Or like rent to buy basically program, because those permits can be cripplingly expensive.
Yeah.
So that's been a discussion that's been opened. And in part, what I'm finding out with the legislature is that people are proposing these things just to have the discussion. Because as you know, commercial fishing is really polarizing in every community in this state, regardless of whether it's a primarily commercial fishing community or a sport fishing community, because people have feelings about what we do with our fish, especially since the commercial fisheries are all at the mouths of rivers versus in them. And then what gets through the commercial fisheries, what gets to the sport fisheries and the subsistence fisheries upriver. And so those conversations affect us all, whether or not we participate in CFEC permit fisheries.
Of course, that's only true here in South Central. There are plenty of in-river commercial fisheries in Western Alaska and
that's
Northern
very
Alaska.
True.
Mm-hmm. A lot of buyback programs are funded by a tax on the fishermen who continue fishing. Small tax.
Landing tax.
Yearly, yeah.
That's a really interesting point. And then the one that's given often as an example in Southeast is the Southeast purse seine fishery. That was funded in part by the feds. So I think that was the National Marine Fisheries Service that helped appropriate funding for that once the fishermen got organized.
I was just waving at my dog who's peeking in through the window there. She'd like to come in on the show too, but she shakes too much. Her collar's too loud.
Poor Abby.
But that's the example that's given a lot, that that fishery worked out. It helped reduce it. It helped increase harvests for the ones that were left. And it's generally regarded as successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. And You know, another thing with the buyback that, you know, they don't talk about a lot. They talk about the graying of the fleet and everything. But one of the things that I know that they would like to see, or like a lot of people would like to see, was more of those permits winding up back in the hands of Alaskans. Because especially drift permits like Bristol Bay, more than half of the drift permits are owned by outsiders.
And that's a good point, too, that a lot of what we're talking about here is not just salmon fisheries. We're talking about the power of our other biggest fisheries, which are our pollock, mm-hmm. Groundfish fisheries, or other groundfish fisheries. Pollock are not groundfish. Those generally are held by out-of-staters. And we have a lot of folks who live out-of-state who hold salmon permits, too. That's a hard debate. How to get things back into the hands of Alaskans, because it's always been hard to decide how we're going to keep our industries here, regardless of which industry you're talking about, because it's easier to live in Seattle, usually.
Yeah. I mean, we have been, what's the word? Not colonized. We're...
I think, depending on who you talk to, I think that's probably the appropriate word.
Yeah, or colonized. What is the word?
What's the next part of the sentence?
We're a country, another country just uses us for resource extraction.
That's colonized.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, we've been colonized by Seattle since forever. So. Yeah.
I mean, you can get since to the Cortez the aspect of it and say pillaged. Ooh. You want to get
Well, here we are at the bottom of the hour this morning on the Kenai Conversation. I know I could use a drop more coffee, and hopefully you will join a cup of coffee and stay with us as well for the second half of the program. Lots of local stuff to continue with this morning on the Kenai Conversation. When we come back, I think we'll dig into maybe annexation and plastic bags in Soldotna. That's always a fun chat, and we'd love to have you in on that part of the conversation as well. 283-8414 is the number. Again, 283-8414. We're going to grab a quick break. Stay with us. Thank you.
Yeah, we're back. Thank you to Dave Brubeck for sitting in from Beyond the Grave, right? Didn't he die last year or something?
It's been fairly recently, the last couple of years, yeah. A big loss.
It is, yeah. The only thing I know about that song, other than it's awesome, is that it is in 5/4 time.
Yes.
And that's why it's called Take Five.
That's right. And that entire album, if you're really into music nerdery, that entire album... Or I shouldn't say the entire album. Most of that album is in some very interesting time signatures. Blue Rondo a la Turk, which you might hear a portion of during the KDLL Evening News at 5:20.
Yeah.
Strange time signatures, anyway.
Ah, I know nothing about music.
No,
I mean, I know what a time signature is, but...
I just know if I like it or not.
That's all you need to know. That's all you need to know.
It's got a good beat, Dick. I can dance to it. I'll give it a 9.
Well, welcome back to the Kenai Conversation this morning. It's Reporters Roundtable this morning, and we've been kind of all over the place talking about the borough budget, the school budget, getting into some fishing issues. And I guess to kind of get back into the program and stick with fishing for just a moment, a relatively big development out of the Board of Fish here recently is that the big Board of Fish meetings are for finally coming back to the Kenai Peninsula in a couple of years.
You know, I was here the last time that they had him here. It was supposed to be a 7 or 8 day meeting. It lasted 14.
Oh, wow. Was it truly as violent and scary as it's been made out to be?
Not at all. You know, and in the ensuing years, you know, it's all been this Kenai River sports fish scare tactics, BS, about, oh, you know, those hairy knuckle dragging commercial fishermen are going to come up with their gaff hooks and billy clubs, and you can't have a meeting here. It's just horrible, you know, and it's just a bunch of BS. That meeting was terrific, though it was incredibly long and dull.
Most meetings are. I sat through all 14 days of the Upper Cook Inlet meeting in Anchorage, and it was equally long and dull.
Punctuated with moments of sheer terror.
Yeah. It was like war, yes.
And deep amusement.
Yeah. You know, at that meeting, though, was kind of... a watershed. It was really the point where sports fishing became ascendant on the Kenai River or in Cook Inlet. That's when it became all powerful at that meeting.
Yeah, and since then, every Board of Fish meeting, when it deals with Upper Cook Inlet issues, for the most part, is centered around allocation of that resource. I mean, that is what the Board of Fish gets together for 2 weeks every year, is to divvy up that resource between the competing groups. There is more to it than that, but that drives the debate for those 2 weeks every 4 years.
And it's not just Kenai River too, because oftentimes it ends up coming down to what the Matanuskas who sit in a valley wants,
right?
Which is a whole gamut of people, in part because there's not that many commercial fishermen that I know of who live in the Matsu Valley. So people who tend to come down from there tend to represent sport fishing interests, and they do rely on fish getting by the commercial fleet in Cook Inlet, and so like, that's a fair argument, but that complicates the argument because the Kenai River has more than enough conflict on its own, not to mention the Kasiloff River, not to mention the Anchor River and all of that. And so that makes those meetings very long and contentious, and notoriously, whenever you mention it to fish and game managers, they just kind of chuckle and then sigh a little bit and their eyes drift off.
And a little bit inside of them dies.
Because this sounds just like war.
When you sit at this meeting, I've seen MASH. This sounds...
When you sit at this meeting, there are these tables packed with these incredibly smart fish and game biologists who sit there 14 days with their laptops, and most of the time don't say a word. They're just there as an extra resource. So I imagine it's not that exciting of a job to get assigned to for 14 days.
Well, you know, I mean, they got to sit there while they listen to partisans butcher science, too.
That's true.
You know, I would love to read their direct messages to one another.
Oh, that
would
be, yeah. I wonder if they're using state cell phones.
I wonder how many memes they're making.
Yeah.
Sorry. No, we can't do that, or else none of them will ever talk to us again, ever.
Sorry, fishing game biologists. Yeah.
But it should be good. I mean, I think the stranglehold the sports fishing industry has is loosened a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think there's... a change in commercial fishermen in Cook Inlet, just in like the numbers and the interest anymore. I mean, I've just been beaten down so much, I think. I mean, the couple of guys I've talked to since I've been back really kind of seems that way.
So if you say that the last one that was here was the ascension of the sports fishing, what would you predict for this one?
Given that it's been eroding a little bit, that ascension, mm-hmm. over the last 20 years, well, maybe 10 years.
Yeah.
A little bit less, I would say. I would say, well, honestly, I don't even know what's on the agenda.
That's true.
So that just occurred to me.
What
am I going to say about this? That's why there's so much controversy over the board appointment of Duncan Fields. Mm-hmm. He's a commercial fisherman, but he's also a lawyer who works for Villages. But Keener River Sports Fish doesn't want him on there. Mm-hmm. To the point that they think the guy down here at the River Center, Robert Ruffner, they think he's a commercial fisherman. They're telling everybody he's a... They've been doing it since 2015. They're trying to portray him as a commercial fisherman.
Such
and
a bad
against,
word, commercial fisherman.
I know. They've demonized it.
What you call me?
Yeah. And so that's why there's so much pressure on that. And there's going to be for the next 2 mm-hmm. years.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's also, you know, moving upriver a little bit just this past winter, and Liz, you were at some of these meetings too, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on in river that's going to have to be dealt with too in terms of water quality and those sorts of things, and those will all have impacts on the level of sport fishing that potentially might be taking place, depending on how those things shake out, because what they're really talking about in terms of these water quality issues is, you know, how many boats is an appropriate number of boats on the river? And that's a lot of people's livelihoods up and down the Kenai River.
Are you not going to say my favorite word? Turbidity?
Oh, I thought it was anadromous.
I can't tell you how many times I've heard the word of anadromous mispronounced.
Or so, turbidity?
Turbidity. Yes. There's a couple of interesting things in there that are both really long-term things that are happening on the Kenai River that are going to influence this 2020 meeting. One is turbidity. It's going to be several years before there's any decision made on that, in part because the DEC is still taking commentary, and then they have to forward that to the EPA, and the EPA has to approve it, and then it has to go to Congress, and then Congress has to make the designation, and then that has to come back to the DEC, and then the DEC has to go through a whole other process of what to do about it. And so this could be multiple years down the line. And then on top of that, up the river, like you said, you have a whole group of people who are contesting this decision anyway, because since those readings were made in 2008 through 2010, I believe, there's been a number of serious changes. I mean, we have there are boat motor restrictions have changed. The number of guides on the river has changed. The distribution of guides on the river
the
has
number
changed.
Of fish available to catch has dropped.
And the type of fish available. And then like the type of gear people are using and the number of hours they're spending on the river. Mm-hmm. All of those variables go into the impacts on the river. And when you talk to different guides, they're generally pretty upset about this, mm-hmm. because it is a direct implication on the ethical nature of their industry. And so you get a pretty good conversation about it. The other thing that goes into play that's a long-term thing is in regards to the 2020 meeting in the peninsula, the commercial fishing industry is going to have a lot to say about that, because the North Pacific Fishery Management Council is currently in the process of rewriting how salmon fisheries are managed in Cook Inlet after that court decision that came out in September 2016. And that's going to be a multiple year process, because the feds are about 3 times as slow as the state and have require 14 times as many people to talk about it. And one of the things that Duncan Fields is tied into that is because he was on the North Pacific Fishery Management Council for many years. And he's been involved in the commercial fisheries in Kodiak, which are not entirely federally managed, but there's more federally managed fisheries out there. And it's an interesting dynamic that it would be to have him on the board, because he'd have the insight for how that process works. And from the couple of people that I've talked to have basically said they're not going to arrive at a formal fishery management plan for quite a while. And so we could have the 2020 meeting down here, and all the proposals will be submitted, and that could all go out the window as soon as the feds decide to regulate that commercial fishery differently. And so, or it could not, or there could be processes in it. The Board of Fish, as I understand it, doesn't really know what their role is going to be in managing these commercial fisheries from here on in. The other dynamic that's happening also is that the feds far, far away in the land of Washington, D.C. are rewriting the Magnuson-Stevens Act. Well, reauthorizing, but they're rewriting it. And part of that is to include pressure from the sport fishing industry to regulate marine sport fishing industries differently under a separate regimen. Because when the Magnuson-Stevens Act was written originally, it didn't really take into consideration a big marine sport fishing industry. But if that happens, that's really going to change some of our sport fishery management here in Cook Inlet and around Alaska. Because we have a lot of marine sport fishing, halibut, salmon, lingcod, rockfish. All of that management could change. And so the Board of Fish is going to have a lot of dynamics to consider, as they always do, but these are pretty big decisions that are coming down their line. And I don't know if the turbidity decision is going to affect all of that, but I assume it will.
I was going to say, I have a really good segue, but
go
first. I was going to say, we can talk about turbidity and then say, Soldatna sent a letter about turbidity and then talk about plastic bags.
Oh, boy.
And I was, look at you.
That is a good
I was really excited about it.
Radio that... queen.
I'm in charge now. See you guys later. No, thank you. No.
That is good. I did have a question about turbidity, though. I haven't written any stories about it, so I don't really know.
I've written too many.
What do you want to know about dirty water? I'll tell you everything. No.
I wrote one, and I got something wrong, and I still feel really bad about it. Sorry, Soldatna City Council.
I haven't floated the entire river, so I don't know this for sure, but isn't the entire Kenai River opaque?
You ask an excellent question, sir. That's one of the arguments that is made against this ruling, because you're right, the entire Kenai River is more turbid than a Clearwater River like the Russian River, because it's glacially fed, and it also has a lot of suspended sediment, and so they take a baseline reading for turbidity in certain periods of the year, and so that's why they gather baseline data, and then they measure it's NTUs, which I'm not going to try to pronounce the actual scientific unit that they use to measure that, but it's the...
Light penetrating measurement, yes.
Yes, it's a fancy science word that I'm not going to try to mispronounce on the radio. But they measure the amount of light that penetrates down into the water column. And if that number goes too far above the baseline that they've measured for the water body, then it is considered too turbid. So the measurement that they're using as baseline is Kenai River specific.
Ah, okay. So it's opaque, but it's too opaque.
It's more opaque than it used to be.
I get it now. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
And again, this is one of many of those topics that we could do a whole hour on. And I should be keeping a list of all the stuff that we should do a whole hour on, including our electrical gremlins at the studio. But that's just for us.
Do KDLL Science Wednesday.
When can you feed these electrical gremlins? Before or after midnight?
Yeah, and no water.
No water. No water. Oh, yeah, that's it, right? Yeah, they can't touch water.
That's right.
But I haven't watched Gremlins enough, obviously.
Well, Kat, you mentioned some City of Soldatna things, and coming up later today, 4 o'clock this afternoon,
exciting.
A work session about the annexation thing, which we haven't heard a whole lot of about here recently, but what do you think is going to be...
I don't know. That's the thing. You know, the Athena Group.
Right?
The
consultants?
The consultants.
Yes.
I don't know why I air quoted that. They are definitely consultants. And I didn't need to say because I'm on the radio. Nobody saw me air quote. but the consultants, when they finished their... consulting, said that there wasn't a lot of favor for annexation, mm-hmm. but if the city wanted to move forward with it, they should do it with an open dialogue and with honesty. And I think the big thing that a lot of the people who are against annexation say is that they feel very betrayed and lied to. And I guess my underlying question that if I could put everybody in Soldatna in one room would be, do you guys even really care? Because I feel like there's this large group of people who really care. There's a small group of people who care but are in favor of it. And then there's just everybody else who's like, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's something that the city is definitely struggling with trying to figure out is, do we listen to this large vocal group or do we push forward and kind of see if there's a pushback,
yeah.
I guess?
Well, you've heard some members of the council state pretty unequivocally that if the area that we want to, there's nine areas
mm-hmm.
that are being looked at around Soldatna. If one of those areas that we're going to be recommended as annexing is a residential mm-hmm. area that nobody wants to be a part of the city of Soldatna, I've heard a number of members of the council say we're not really interested in that.
Exactly.
And that when you take those residential areas away, there are a couple of pockets, you know, some commercial areas and that sort of thing, but you take away those residential areas, and all of a sudden you're left with very small plots that, is it worth it to bring those under the umbrella of the city? And if you have to update infrastructure mm-hmm. to meet code, and if you have to provide more services and those sorts of things, it quickly becomes a question of, is the extra revenue we're going to get going to even pay for the investment we have yeah. To make this part of the city proper?
And then that's the other thing that I hear at the meetings all the time too, is we're going to have to make money off of this. We're not going to do it if we're going to lose money.
Right.
So I don't know. At this point, it's kind of a toss-up to see what happens. I mean, there's a new city manager.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be a new person on city council.
Yep.
Keith Baxter is leaving us for the great city of Anchorage.
Yeah.
And it's just, I don't know, how long has the annexation thing been going on?
A few years now.
Yeah, a few years.
Well, and the broader issue is that there is an appetite for commercial development mm-hmm. in and around Soldotna.
Exactly.
But the city of Soldotna is quite small by Alaska standards. Like 6 square miles is mm-hmm. is the city proper. And you look at that relative to its neighbor in Kenai. Kenai is huge. Yeah.
And then you take, that was a major issue in the marijuana discussion when commercial marijuana was mm-hmm. legalized. I think they did, I was at one of the work sessions and they were just drawing lines all over this map and they
yes.
led to one small section.
Uh-huh.
They were like, you can open right there.
You can stand on this corner yeah. on this rock and yeah.
And so it's a really, really small city.
Mm-hmm.
Annexing would probably bring a lot of benefits commercially, financially. It's just figuring out whether or not they can find a spot where nobody's going to get too upset and where
yeah.
it'll actually make the money, because
yeah.
that's the big thing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it'll be interesting to see, again, with the new city manager, mm-hmm. where this conversation goes and how things are going to move forward now in the coming year, because this for a long time has been slated as a huge issue for the mm-hmm. city and a lot of questions as to just simply how are you going to deal with
yeah.
this, because no one argues that there's not, in any municipality, there's always a need for more revenue and mm-hmm. a desire for more services and better roads and all those sorts
yeah.
of things. But
and at this point, I feel like they've put so much time and effort into researching it
yeah.
and figuring it out. They got to just annex something.
Come
on. You're really upset
just
if they did.
Just something. Anything.
Wildlife refuge. Just annex
yeah.
the whole thing.
No, don't do that.
Well, you know, in the closing few moments, Jay, before the show started, you and I were talking a little bit about sort of some broader topics about, you know, how folks view the press and those sorts of things, and to kind of segue into that, another thing going on in Soldotna that just came out last week is this an idea for a plastic bag ban ordinance, and sort of tying those two things together, it's interesting that you know, in all the stories that we put out and the Clarion puts out, we don't get at KDLL we don't get a ton of comments on our stories, but this one generated some comments
yeah.
and this one fires people up and people are really engaged and to a certain extent enraged about this.
It is extremely polarizing
it
too.
Is.
I work on Saturdays and I lay out the paper for the Sunday paper, and I did two stories, the plastic bag ban and the March for Our Lives.
Oh.
And then I went out and went down to Homer for Sunday and I came back and I was like, holy cow, there's a lot of notifications. Like, those two stories themselves were like, no.
Yeah.
But the plastic bag one was really, really polarizing. We had some comments that we had to block because they were very vulgar. We had one that was really hilariously vulgar, but I loved it. And it's just trying to, I don't know, it's, what do you think?
it's interesting because, I mean, no one is pro trash bags littering
yeah.
the streets. No
mm-hmm.
one is pro that. But making the case that that you need to go back to the way people did things really not all that long ago, Jay, I'm sure you remember. I even remember a time before plastic
yeah.
bags.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I was a box boy when I was 10.
Yes.
And they were paper bags.
Yes.
And I always wrapped my textbooks in the paper bags. And
yes.
I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
Paper bags are great. Plastic bags, probably a little bit more useful, but at the end of the day, I mean, how many times do you go to Progress Day
mm-hmm.
or just any music in the park or something and you can get a reusable bag there?
Mm-hmm.
It's not, I know that you can get some nice ones from KDLL even.
That's right. Yes, we do have beautiful, lovely, high quality, high strength, durable tote bags available at KDLL.
We do?
We do.
Oh.
They're fantastic.
News
oh.
to Jay.
Oh, no, these are the good ones.
Yeah.
Oh.
These are the really good ones.
Oh, no, wait. I think I do recall them.
So just before I moved here, I came from Chicago where we banned plastic bags.
And how did that go over?
Interestingly enough, there was a very similar discussion. Obviously, the scale is much larger. The Chicago Tribune serves like 14 million people in their circulation or whatever. So I remember the comment war. Mm-hmm. I remember there being incredible propaganda campaigns to say this is terrible, it's limiting our freedom. Everybody was fine. Everybody got fine. Over yeah. it.
And I don't think that this is an issue where you're going to find much blowback from retailers because those plastic bags that they get in the plastic bags that they get in by the truckload cost them a lot of money to just give away.
Yeah,
that's a good point. We have a phone call.
I am so excited.
Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. Hey, this is Bill. I don't mean to be argumentative, but I think it was Shailen just made a comment about nobody wants to be pro-garbage and this and that. I think the better point is that I think there's a large part of the population, not through any malice or anything, but that could not possibly be bothered with the issue. And I think that's more concerning to me than the amount of people that are pro, let's throw our plastic all over the place. Because I don't think they're there, but I think you get a lot of part of the population, not including myself, that it's just not an issue.
And I agree with that because I have so many reusable bags. But if I get into Freddy's and realize that I left one in my car, I won't walk back for it. And that's something that I struggle with as somebody who likes to pretend that they're really involved in this plastic bag issue. But I'll take the plastic bags and I'll use them to pick up dog poop. And like I reuse them. I don't throw them on the ground. But I think it's something that you can either take it or leave it.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're going to take it or leave it.
Yeah, yeah. And Bill, that's a great point. There is so much sort of out of sight, out of mind to this kind of an issue. I mean, that's the whole point of a disposable bag is that it's out of sight, out of mind. You use it once and that's it. The problem is that they tend to stick around for a lot longer than anyone would care to. But, yeah.
Yeah, if I could add in just more, you know, those recycled bags at Fred's and probably other places, I think Fred's had them down to 99 cents when they did. I probably bought at least a half a dozen of them and just gave them to people.
Yeah.
That's great.
And I put a couple in every car. So, you know, I'm not saying that I've gone into Fred's too where I forgot mine and I'm only getting a couple items. I'll do one plastic bag and then recycle it. But they make them so that we can't get them. I'll have to walk back and I'll do it.
Exactly. And I think that's the thing that will spur change me actually having to go back and do it.
And Soldatna should have an interesting conversation about it because there's a number of models too that are different than just outright banning it. Like there's a store chain in the lower 48 called Aldi that forces you to rent your carts and they don't have plastic bags on hand. And then there's other places that charge you to use plastic bags. And so Soldatna could consider those rather than outright banning them, but it should be a really interesting chance to open up the conversation at city council. And I'm sure the suggestions will come forward.
You know, really quickly, I'm curious, what were some of the comments online of people who, why did they want plastic bags? Were they upset that?
There was one that I'm specifically remembering that was very upset at the trajectory with which his hometown had gone to being very liberal and saying specifically like using them throughout the house. You know, I think he was like, I always use them to pick up my dog. Feces? Is that a
radio word? That's fine.
Okay. And just use them. You know, like, I can name a million uses for them. Like, I put them in my little garbage can in my room.
Fish cleaning.
Yeah. When I go down to the river and go fishing, I'll just throw everything in there. But,
And I think the bigger issue that's coming out is that people know that this is going to be a divisive issue, and they're saying, of all the things that we could be talking about, of all the problems that are going on with our city and Why plastic bags? Why are we going to fight about this? I think that's kind of coming to the top.
And you know what? I think we can fight about more than one thing at once. I think we
can walk and chew gum.
Distraction fight.
That's right.
We can do it.
Man. So what have you guys got? We have like less than a minute. Yeah. Just less than a minute. What have you guys got coming up, you know, without tipping your hands to your competition here in public radio?
Well, everybody should be ready for what's going on. Obviously, coming down the fishing season, we've got a interesting king here coming down the line because everything looks good for us, but things are not good in Southeast. Things are not really good in Copper River, and things are not okay really in the Yukon. And then what's going on with the borough, the agenda just came out yesterday for the March 3rd meeting. Prepare yourselves for the hospital service area line debate yet again.
Oh, exciting. Sure. Tomorrow, the Supreme Court will be at Kenai Central High School. school. And I think everybody is welcome to go. I know everybody's welcome to go, and I think everybody should go because it's going to be a very interesting case.
It's going to be a lot of fun, yeah.
It's going to be super cool. And then down the line from there, school board meeting on Monday. I'll be there. Should be exciting. All right. And the annexation meeting tonight. Oh,
don't
so
forget that.
Annexation. Also, 5 o'clock is in Soldat, and you can come in on the Cooper Landing
bypass. Yes, and also hear a bit more about that story. I was at the public meeting in Cooper Landing last night, and we'll have more about that tonight at 5:20.
I will be there listening.
Great. Well, you know, I think we're at the end here because I hear music.
Oh, it's that lovely Dave Brubeck.
Thank you guys.
Thank you both so much for coming in.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Captain Liz, thanks so much.
No problemo.
It is 11 a.m., and you're listening to KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. We are listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. You've been listening to the Kenai Conversation.
Major funding for On Point is provided by GEICO, offering auto insurance coverage for cars, trucks, or SUVs, and providing 20-